Hello, and welcome to a very special edition of the Fremantle Press podcast called Love to Read Local Radio. Love to Read Local is a week-long celebration that will take place in 2020 from 29th of May to 7th of June. It's a statewide initiative to showcase Western Australia's many, many wonderful writers and illustrators and the books they create. As you can hear, I'm not your usual host, Rebecca Higgy. My name is Josephine Taylor, and I'm Associate Editor at Westerly Magazine and an Adjunct Senior Lecturer in Writing and English at Edith Cowan University. My debut novel, Eye of a Rook, will be published by Fremantle Press in November. My first guest is someone very well known to me and to many of you. She's a colleague from Westerly with a fantastic new book out with Picador called The Salt Madonna. I'm delighted to welcome Catherine Noske to Love to Read Local Radio. So, Kate, first up, it would be great to hear a little bit about you and how you came to be living and writing in Western Australia.
Oh, that's a nice point to start. Firstly, thank you for having me. It's lovely to be chatting with Love to Read Local Radio. I think this is really cool. Obviously, nice to be talking with you, Jo, as Westerly friends and colleagues. But it's also, you know, been a lovely moment for me with the release of my book to celebrate a little bit the wonderful Western Australian writing community we have and the huge number of people who've supported me. So it's been a really fun time for me with the book coming out in that sense. Myself, how I came here. I finished a PhD in creative writing at Monash University in Melbourne in 2014 and spent a little bit of time there working as a sessional and casual lecturer before the chance to edit Westerly came up. And I was familiar with Westerly. I knew the journal through my research and through my reading, but I also just had huge respect for what it represented as a journal coming from a place, from a community. And that was something that felt particularly special living and working in Melbourne, where there are quite a number of journals and the community is diverse and rich and wonderful, but also doesn't have that centre that seems to happen here in WA, where you have a community coming together in very particular ways. The challenge of coming from Victoria to Western Australia was really exciting for those reasons. And when I was offered the chance to edit Westerly, I jumped at it. I came over here and I spent the next couple of years working on a casual basis as the editor alone, and then took on a role as lecturer here at UWA in creative writing as well. And I do want to just take a moment to recognise, obviously, podcast is an audio product, not a visual medium, but I need to acknowledge that we are meeting here today on the land of the Whadjuk Noongar people here at UWA in our lovely sound recording booth, and that I pay my respects to elders past, present and future of this lovely, lovely country that we meet on. So place has always been important to me, and recognising, you know, that custodianship of country from the Noongar people was, you know, another really exciting element of Westerly, being able to involve those Aboriginal voices in the magazine in a way that was much richer and more dynamic than it had been over the 60-year history. There was lots of wonderful, exciting things to come to with Westerly, and the last few years here working at UWA as well has really added to that.
Hmm. Thanks for that, and thanks for the acknowledgement as well. I think that from the launch of your book, it's really clear how the Western Australian writing community has embraced you, and I think that's a reflection of the way in which you've supported and embraced West Australian writers since your time here as well.
I hope I've been supported and embraced writers. That's a very nice way to think about it. I feel like I have been embraced, most certainly. The community here is wonderful, and it's been an absolute privilege to be based here and working within that community. The moment of the release of the book was really joyful for me, in the sense that there's been a lot of writers and editors here have helped me in that process over the last few years, and the chance to celebrate that, something that was, you know, my own and not just part of a bigger role in terms of Westerly, was really lovely as a way of recognising how that community has supported me as well.
Mm, good. Well, let's move on to the book then. So rather than me leaping in with questions about it, I'm wondering if you could briefly introduce listeners to the Salt Madonna, the world of the Salt Madonna, and some of its primary kinds of characters and plot elements.
Oh, okay, sure thing. So the Salt Madonna is set on a fictional, I stress that very heavily, fictional island off the southern coast of Australia, and it's based roughly on my childhood, the place I grew up, but it's also partly based around my fascination with islands to begin with. Islands have always been intriguing and enticing to me. They're strange places. They are really, in some senses, contained, almost claustrophobic spaces to write about. But at the same time, they have an energy that is unique and informed by the conditions of their being. So I've always found islands really interesting. I spent a year travelling after my PhD before my PhD, and one of the most wonderful places I went was an island off the coast of France, the Île d'Ouessant, which is technically the westernmost point of Europe, but so often ignored that they need 6 lighthouses around the island to stop people hitting it. I had to get across on a fishing boat because there weren't regular passage to the island, and it was all very strange and wonderful. And so, yeah, I've always been fascinated with those spaces, and that's very much the backdrop to this story, the strangeness that can happen in a small community and in an island community. And alongside that, I was interested in questions of how Australia as a nation reconciles itself with the history of colonialism and the continued implications of colonialism in our contemporary, day-to-day lives. So there was sort of this dual aspect to setting up the book that was important for me, not just the space in and of itself, but the space as a symbol for these bigger traumas and bigger questions of Australian history. And the story that came out with that was very much one about power and about how stories and the telling of stories interacts with truth and with historical truths, and how trauma can sit underneath the community and how community has to resolve their own traumas. So there were a few sort of elements that impelled the story in that sense.
Mm. I'm interested in that idea of the island as a kind of hothouse. It's like a sort of, because of its relative isolation, a kind of way of putting people in a situation where they're under stress in some ways just simply through their initial
Simply through their being,
On the island.
Mm. That to me was partly derived from my childhood in a small rural village in southwest Victoria, which is, nowhere near as isolated, obviously, as an island off the coast. But, it seemed to me that growing up I had a way of life that was very much distinct from some of the stories I heard from, friends at university later on, and the general expectations for a childhood and for your teenage years that I saw in pop culture and in movies and in television. There is very much that sense that not all experiences in Australian lives are going to be reconcilable with this pop culture idea of what it means to grow up, and that those places where there are idiosyncratic ways of life, or there are, ways of life that are often ignored or peripheral in the way in which we speak about ourselves as a nation are really interesting to think about.
Mm. So a way of life which is somehow kind of liminal and on the border and in between places.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what about the idea of it being a fiction? Because it isn't an island that exists. Why didn't you, for instance, set it on an island that you knew in real life?
That was a long process. It took me a long time to build the setting, so to speak. I started writing it on a landscape that was where I grew up, was my childhood home, and I found in the writing that setting was too real. In a way, it restricted my freedom as a writer to write about the ideas I wanted to engage with, because I was too beholden to that place, to the memories I shared with it, and too beholden in terms of sentiment as well, too nostalgic often about it, not really able to see it clearly in some senses.
So in a way it offered you a freedom and perhaps gave you a slight different distance from that autobiographical element?
Absolutely, yeah. So, obviously there are traces of my own experiences in this work and places that I recognise, others may not, but which are clearly, you know, based on my own life. But, yeah, it was really important to make that very deliberate shift into the fictional as a means for detaching myself from my own history and from my own experiences and opening up a greater freedom around the writing.
Mm. It's quite a complex structure. It's easy to read in the sense of that it's a narrative that really propels itself. But I noticed that you have the narrator, the reflective voice of Hannah, who's one of the primary characters, certainly the narrator. You have her as a reflective voice in the first person, but you also have Hannah as part of the narrative as well as the third person. So why did you do that?
I forgot to answer your question about characters before,
didn't I?
That's okay.
We'll go on to it.
The complex structure, I mean, yes, the structure is a little bit complex. And again, that was a deliberate manoeuvre on my part, partly because I couldn't reconcile this story into any one perspective. There was too much that one person couldn't know, but also partly because I didn't want it to be a question of who was telling the truth. I wanted it to be a question in this story of, is the truth possible? And my way of asking that was to set up Hannah in the first person as this framing narrator who is trying to reconcile herself with this story, trying to think back to what it means to her, think through its significance. And her way of doing that is to herself start to tell it through the third person and imagining herself as a character there. So that layering of somebody imagining themselves or projecting themselves into a space, to me, was important in terms of the unreliability it created and the fact that you can't trust Hannah's telling any more than you can trust any of the perspectives within it. Yeah. I wanted the reader to think very carefully about how much of this story is real. I'm using air quotes there. Again, not a visual medium, but how much of it is real and how much of that story is Hannah projecting her own desires and her own wish fulfillment onto that space or trying to justify her own involvement or her own guilt.
I really like that, and I love that sort of ambiguity that's sustained right throughout the narrative. It's a wonderful tension between the whole idea of a crime or a miracle that is on the cover of the book as well, and is sustained throughout. And I thought that was a really interesting balancing act. I guess one comment I'd make too is that sort of meta-fictive quality at the beginning that I noticed particularly in an early scene where Hannah is arriving at the island and she's talking about Darcy, and then it's like, wait a minute, and you redo the scene again. And it signals really clearly to the reader early on. I think it's an important signal to say this is how we have to kind of approach this material. We're not going to be certain about anything.
That was that little sequence was actually the first time I wrote that framing voice and that narrative interjection. It was a really important one for me as a writer as well, going, no, wait, what if you can't trust this? What if this character is not actually telling us the truth? Or what if this, you know, this idea of an omniscient narrator is, you know, imposed or flawed or somehow uncertain? And that idea of omniscience being questionable is one that I really wanted to push at.
Good. Yeah, I'd like to go back to the idea of that tension in a moment, but perhaps we could talk to the listeners a little bit about the actual what happened.
Sure.
As much as we can,
sure.
Because there's certain things we want to keep, you know, mystery.
I get distracted by this all the time because the things I find most exciting about the book are those sort of subtextual themes.
Mm.
But the what happens is you know, actually quite concrete in many ways. It's quite a simple narrative. And one of the criticisms that my family had in reading it was not much actually happens.
Mm.
I know, it's the ideas that count. but so the basis of the plot line is simply that Hannah is returning to her childhood home. Her mother is dying and she's having to you know, not only deal with the trauma of her, the loss, the impending loss of her mother, but also reconcile herself with her decision to leave in the first place and what leaving has meant for her life and her relationship with her childhood home. And in that, she takes on the role of the local school teacher. She is a teacher in her professional life, and she takes on a short-term role as teacher on the island while she's caring for her mother. And one of her pupils, Mary, begins to act in slightly strange ways and suddenly disappears from the classroom and before a whole set of wild rumours begin to circulate about her. And Mary becomes quite an important figure for the community. I'm trying not to give too much away.
It's tricky.
It is tricky. Mm. But the big question in this story is, you know, what has happened to Mary and how can we understand what has happened to Mary, and is the community's version of what happened the truth, or is Mary's version the truth, or, you know, all the myriad versions in between?
Mm. With that tension of about where the truth is that something that you had to remind yourself of as you were writing, or is it something that naturally happened that you were able to kind of hold that tension?
I'm not a plotter. No, okay. You might have guessed. Plot's not my strong point. So for me, the idea of not quite knowing what is happening in a story is really quite familiar. But at the same time, yeah, it was something I had to hold forefront in the actual writing, because normally in my writing process, that question of what is happening, what do I want to have happen here, what's at the heart of this story, would resolve naturally as you wrote and as you fine-tuned. And it was a very different writing process for me to lean into that uncertainty and try and embed that uncertainty as to what's actually happened in the work. To the extent that, you know, there are questions that I leave unanswered that I very deliberately didn't want to answer for myself so that I could, you know, use that as a jumping off point for letting characters be uncertain as well and sort of experience that vicariously through them.
Mm. I think it works really well, but I take issue with your point about the plot, because I think the plot is actually very strong, and I think it's beautifully balanced between the different voices.
Well, thank you. That's very kind.
No, it's true, and I really like the way you've structured it through religious, the religious year, is that right? The Lent and so on?
Yeah, so part of the structure of the book is that it's broken up into quite a lot of fragments. Each set of fragments is a different grouping of perspectives, and they're captured within points of the year defined by the religious calendar and the calendar of, you know, saints' birthdays and events and fasts and feasts and all that sort of thing. And partly this is a book which is interested in institutions and structures and the way in which they dictate knowledge, or they have their own true version of events or their own decided logic to them. And I wanted to just sit the chaos of the story against this very rigid religious structuring of a calendar to show the sort of, you know, almost ambiguity of that relationship between how, you know, we impose meaning on something through these sort of calendars or these organisational points of logic.
Yes, and I think that points to another element that I'm really interested in. It's how we read meaning into things and the stories which we apply to things that don't make sense to us, which in a way kind of takes on a life of its own. Reminds me a little bit of Gillian Meir's Fine Flower, where you have a kind of isolated community and yet you have these incredibly sort of small-minded at times prejudices and just rising to the surface and somehow taking hold of a community.
That's a very flattering comparison, so thank you. But there was actually another Gillian Meir's book that was really important to me in the writing. That was her more recent work, False Bread, partly because I love horses, as anybody who will have read this book will be able to tell, but partly because, yeah, absolutely, she's looking at a family in that book and the way in which different members of the family know that history differently and have lived that family life in very different ways.
And also that the layers of history as well, because there's a lot of guilt in this book too with Hannah. There's sort of guilt around the events that unfold. There's guilt, it seems to be, with her mother. There's guilt around her family history which is similar to the Gillian Mears. But I'd also like to go to, because I did have a horse question for you, and I love foals bred too. I think that no one who reads the book can sort of doubt, you can feel the love there. And it's a way of sort of embedding the reader into the environment as well. I felt really embedded into it. And I think there's a care and concern that comes out through Hannah's interaction with the horses, the black horse and Ghost. And so what did you feel that you wanted the horses to carry in this novel?
I don't know that my desire for the horses was quite that conscious, to be honest. Mm-hmm. The horses were almost an instinctive element of the setting for me, in the sense that they very much defined my childhood. And as I said, that childhood space really did inform a lot of the early work in the book. But they also are, for me, a metaphor for the way in which writing should feel. Mm-hmm. So I find myself thinking about that relationship between a horse and its rider a lot when I'm writing, and that probably subconsciously informed that desire to want to keep coming back to the horse, sort of horse scenes and the horse space as a metaphor in the book as well.
I think that works really well. I'm reminded of a scene in the book where she talks, I think it might be a part of the reflective narrative, and she talks about the way she used to ride, leaning forward and over the horse, and how you'd be kind of one with the horse, and the way in which dressage is so different to that. And I was thinking at the time about that process of writing, and in some ways how you have to give yourself over to that beast that contains both of you.
Yeah, exactly. It's very much that relationship between the writer being, you know, driven and compelled by the story, or the story being controlled and shaped by the writer. It's a symbiotic sort of relationship. And at the same time, you know, one of the most powerful elements of riding for me is the feeling you get through the reins and communicating with a horse. The touch of the reins can be cotton light in your hands, but at the same time invested with such strength and with, you know, 500 kilos of raw animal power beneath you as well. And that sort of balance of the lightest of touches conveying the strongest of sensations is something that to me is very much metaphoric for writing that works well as well. So I know when I'm writing that if I feel anything approaching that sensation, that, you know, my draft is heading in the right direction.
Absolutely. A bit like skiing or shooting that impossible goal that, you know,
precisely,
as the ball leaves your hand.
That sense of something outside yourself, something bigger than yourself, and that sense too of you know, giving yourself to that moment.
Mm. Taking us back to the content, the book has a tremendous amount of a violence in it of different sorts, a lot of it to do with men. What is there in that that informs the narrative? What is it that's important about that?
I think for me what was important about that was really the sensation that this violence in our national history is not something we have dealt with, and that it is, you know, simmering to erupt in moments in myriad ways. I think too, growing up rural, you felt that violence a little closer to the bone, perhaps. There was a little bit more of the brutal maybe in life outside a city. Including in the very, you know, most simple terms of the way in which people talk with each other, the sorts of language that's used, the more overt awareness of environmental damage, the damage to communities through trauma and grief, and, you know, the awareness of race relations in our country being a site of real tension and difficulty. The terrible things that Indigenous people have to live with and suffer through, and the way in which that's shaped, you know, the experience of life for huge communities. It's all of that to me felt close to the bone in writing the book, and the only way I could think to sort of embed that in the plot line was to show all of those ugly moments of violence simmering beneath very mundane, otherwise, you know, quotidian life.
Mm. And I think you do that really well. I mean, it's not only a kind of immersive sense that you're in that world, but it's also in the history, in the journals, and, you know, so there's a kind of layering of this violence that's happening on a sort of chronological kind of basis. So it feels really immersive in that way. So, yeah, that's terrific. Looking at another element, I'm thinking of Father John and the Women's Auxiliary.
Yeah.
So there is a kind of a mass hysteria, I guess, or collective mania, I think Gal Jones refers to.
It slowly rises in the novel. That was very much informed by Randolph Stowe's novel Tourmaline as well, this sense that a community that is desperate, that has everything to lose, is the sort of community who is going to be vulnerable to that vast structure of hope and delirium, and the way in which, you know, it's often very hard to draw a line between what is a hopeful projection of the future and one that is, you know, deluded or delusional. So partly that element of the book for me was, again, about the claustrophobia and tension of an island, but partly too it was about questioning those truths again and in a very blunt sense, looking at the way in which, you know, the narratives put forward by an institution or by a single person defining a truth can create damage, can create fallout, the way in which a narrative can, you know, quickly become something that is out of control.
Hmm. What I think you do really well is in the scenes where there's a hallucinatory even element, which reminds me a little bit of Voss, Patrick White, is that you're right in the middle of it and you're feeling like, yes, the wife is there, you know, that all makes perfect sense.
Yeah, and so that's just Father John you're referring
yes,
to there.
Yeah.
He's the local priest in the island and he's lost his wife and he sort of brings her to life by sheer force of will to start with, but himself becomes more and more deluded by this apparition that he has imagined or created to the point where it does, you know, again, it's, I wanted to ask, where do you draw that line between wishful thinking and sheer hallucination?
Yeah, and what I like about it is there's no sort of scepticism when you're in the moment. It's only afterwards that the moment might be undercut by another person's perspective or by seeing it from the sort of more crime kind of perspective. But I think too, there's not a massive amount of cruelty here from you as an author as well, in the sense that I feel compassion for different characters as well. It's like Mrs. Keelor, for instance, who is the Women's Auxiliary embodied, I guess, who could be really a caricature, but you keep her quite rounded, and there is a level of compassion there, or I felt. Is that correct?
I'm glad you felt that. I spent a lot of time working on Mrs. Keeler, and she's definitely the character I found the most difficult to write in some ways. I didn't want any one person to be to blame for this. This isn't a story that is necessarily interested in, you know, definitive legal justice or blame. It's a story that's trying to ask how these moments of violence can happen in the first place, and how, you know, it takes a whole community to enable this. And part of that was an interest in thinking about the Royal Commission into the Institutional Response to Sexual Abuse, and the way in which that turned as an event, it turned around not the perpetrators of the abuse, but the ways in which institutions had scaffolded that and created it either as a culture or through, you know, a sheer lack of compassion and care for victims. And all of those questions to me seemed much more important than really the event itself, in terms of Australian history at least, in the sense that colonialism as an event, if you want to consider it as an event, can be defined as having happened in the past. And if we're talking in structures of blame and legal justice, you could talk about that as having been dealt with in a legal system. But the reality is that colonialism as an event has continued on long past that moment of history, that it is still a lived reality for many people. And if you stick within that narrative of blame and guilt in a legal sense, then you remove all of the nuance of that question of how these, you know, how these elements of trauma are run in perpetuity through our community. Mm. So those questions of compassion for the characters seem to me to be a vehicle for making that point that, you know, it's not about the individual, this story. It's about the way in which everybody is involved in something bigger than themselves.
Mm. But what's good in the book is that you also knit that into the plot. So you have Hannah thinking about her ancestors, the Mulvey family, and you have her in and their, I guess, how they're implicated in the history, the colonial history. And you also have her as a teacher. She's come back to the island. She's now acting as a teacher. And so she's thinking about what is her responsibility as a teacher if there is something that's happened to her student, Mary, and what can she do? So it's not only, and that these aren't only abstract ideas, you've really embedded them into the narrative.
Yeah, the choice to make her a teacher was one that I dwelt over a little bit as well, in the sense that, you know, as a teacher, she's poised between generations in that community in a way as well. She's not just relating with the parents and of the parents' generation, but she is interacting with the children as the next generation of that community. And it was a way to see her as not only, you know, separate from both those sort of groups, but also, you know, the hinge between them, and see her perspective as thinking about that longer life of the community, both backwards and forwards.
I love the way too that you're talking about the hinge, and we've talked a little bit about Mrs. Keylor and Father John and so on, but the young people are also that way of life, that the use of alcohol and the kind of nighttime craziness and so on was really reminded me of that, of growing up.
Just in case mum's listening, that's not real. there was no sneaking out. It is a very lived experience that, in the sense that I don't know of a community that doesn't have some awareness of their younger generations need to let off steam, however you want to characterise that.
So, Kate, we've talked a bit about your book. I'd really urge all readers to go out there and buy a copy of this book, particularly at a time when we're probably looking for things to do at home. I thought it'd be really nice for us to talk a little bit about Westerly.
Oh, me too.
So to take a bit of the pressure off you, you mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Last Friday, we were both at the launch of Donna Mazza's book, Fauna, down in Bunbury, which was a wonderful occasion, and I really enjoyed seeing the photos of you guys signed each other's books and so on. And I'm remembering back to the appearance of her short story, The Exhibit, upon which the novel is based. I'm wondering how you feel about that kind of relationship in relation to Westerly and your role in Westerly.
Absolutely. I mean, that story to me was a really rich piece of writing back in 2015. We published it in our second issue of 2015 for anybody who wants to go find that on Westerly's website. And it was, you know, a piece of writing that to me was doing everything that we look for in Westerly. It was offering some sort of speculation about what it meant to be Western Australian, for a start, but it was also speculating about possible futures for our country, about social truths involved in that, and it was speculating about some of the pressure points that we might come to face in much broader cultural terms as well. So I always loved that story, and it was a joint winner of our Patricia Hackett Prize that year, which was really lovely to see happen. But last weekend in Bunbury was just fantastic. It's nice to watch the journey of a piece of writing from that story through development, and Donna applied for some funding to help her develop that writing that we wrote a letter of support for, and you know, watch her progress through the process of the manuscript into publication and release it in the book Fauna, which is out from Allen and Unwin. So it's really rewarding to watch that personal journey, but it's also encouraging in the sense that, I mean, you know as well as I do that this is really what we try to do here, is to develop and encourage Western Australian writing and support it any way we can.
Absolutely. I agree, and I can think of different people who have begun their literary careers at Westerly.
Yeah, the journal had a pretty huge heritage of that when I started with it, and that was something that seemed important to keep fostering, emerging writers as being, you know, a linchpin of a writing community, in the sense that that's the next generation of writing that we're going to see. And, you know, we developed our writers development program, yes, that you manage now for that purpose. But also, you know, to recognise the sort of continued evolution of literature in our state too, and the connections between Western Australian writing and writing from all across Australia, the ways in which, you know, writing coming from the East Coast can feed into and inform debates and discourses that we're having here, and vice versa, the way we can get Western Australian writers read more broadly, both nationally and internationally, to allow that perspective space and time in the national agenda.
And do you think Westerly also carries that kind of role or sense of transition for a writer as well, where you might go from gaining confidence through being published by Westerly, for instance, and moving towards sort of going out into the world as a writer?
I hope so. I mean, you might see this more than I do in the Writers Development Program. Is that something that you've seen happening there?
Absolutely, yes. I've been really interested. I'm thinking about Maddie Godfrey, her recent success, who was in the Writers Development Program a couple of years ago.
She was, yeah. She's now the Cat Musket Fellow.
That's
which is really exciting.
That's it.
So, yeah, there's lots of stories for me like that of writers beginning to develop a CV as an emerging writer and make their way to full manuscript publication.
Yes. And I think there's also we do offer feedback when people submit if their writing is rejected, because we do receive so much writing, and it's really hard to reject so much wonderful writing.
It's the worst part of the job.
Yes, absolutely. And I think when it wasn't long after I began in 2017, that I wrote So Your Piece Has Been Rejected, because I knew what it's like to be on the receiving end of that, and I wanted to communicate something of all the elements of that,
We both know what it's like to be on the rejecting end. That happens.
So for readers who might want to read an issue of Westerly, are there any, I mean, I know we could kind of talk about for hours our favourite pieces, but is there one that just comes to mind of recent issues?
Oh, I think for me, Matthew Hooton's piece in the last issue was a real standout in terms of, yes, a piece of work that is highly experimental, but one that is deep ethical questions inside it in terms of the way in which our society thinks about various elements of, you know, the sorts of forces and powers going on within mass consumerism and capitalism. But alongside that, the work that Elfie Shiasaki is doing as our editor for Indigenous writing needs to be acknowledged. She is an absolute powerhouse, and I've loved watching her develop a really strong cohort of Aboriginal voices across the last 4 years of issues. And, you know, the fact too that we now have Paul Munden as our poetry editor and Susan Medalia as our prose editors, both going to be bringing their own takes and their own inflections to their selection of good writing. It's all very exciting to see that happening. Yeah. So, yeah, I don't know that there's any one piece that typifies all of those things happening for me, but just a general sense that Westerly is really enjoyable work right now. It is, yeah.
It's really good fun. Kate, thanks so much for being part of Love to Read Local Radio. It's been lovely talking to you.
And it's been very pleasant.
Yeah. Love to Read Local Radio is brought to you by Fremantle Press with support from the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund. And Love to Read Local, a week-long celebration of WA's writers, illustrators and the books they create, is brought to you by Writing WA. Check out the show notes for more details about Writing WA, information on how to get a copy of The Salt Madonna by Catherine Noske, and further info on books we've mentioned today. The notes will also have links to our website at Westerly, where you can subscribe or buy individual copies of past issues or download an online special issue for free. And we love interacting with you on social media too. If you enjoyed this episode, be sure to subscribe to the Fremantle Press podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, SoundCloud, or anywhere you get your favourite podcasts. Thanks for listening.